Coming up on Tech News Weekly, I, Micah Sargent, and my co-host Jason Howell start out the show by talking to TechDirt's Mike Masnick about the California Assembly passing a bill that, if gone into law, would make it possible for parents to sue social media companies for addicting their children to social media. Then we talk to Tom Merritt. You can check out Tom's new Substack, but he talks about DuckDuckGo and how it may not be as private as we once thought. Before we round out the show with our stories of the week, first, I go into detail and depth about the struggles I've had with Apple's self-service repair program and its malicious compliance, and Jason Howell rounds things out with his own conversation about social media dissociation. It is a great show. It's super packed, so stay tuned for Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 236, recorded Thursday, May 26th, 2022.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Melissa. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit.
And by checkout.com. Modern businesses need flexible payment systems that can help them adapt to change, grow, and scale fast. Discover how checkout.com can help your business thrive at checkout.com/TNW.
And by ZipRecruiter. Certain people make my life easier by helping me out, and ZipRecruiter makes hiring easier because they do the work for you. How? Well, ZipRecruiter's technology finds great candidates, and you can invite them to apply. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNW to try it for free. Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. And I'm excited for today because we've got two of like my favorite people on the internet on the show today. So
there's a little, a little preview. Let's actually get right into it. So California, while I think the rest of the U.S. is looking at different means of curtailing, controlling, changing, updating, making changes to social media, California has done a thing of its own with AB 2408. Joining us today to talk about California's new bill that was just passed is TechDirt's own Mike Masnick. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to get you on to talk about this. I think before we get into the nitty-gritty details of what's going on here and I get a chance to ask you some of your thoughts on it, I was hoping you could start by giving us sort of a very bland, very boring understanding of what AB 2408 is set out to do.
Sure. And I should note that the bill is not law yet. It's passed the assembly. It still has to go through the Senate, but it looks like that's going to happen. But the bill is a response to the idea that social media is somehow addictive, specifically for children, and so it's a response to that, and it has different provisions in there, effectively trying to say that companies, social media companies, cannot try to addict children is the shortest version of it. If it does and any harm comes to any child because of the addictive nature of any social media platform, it allows parents to sue and, in fact, to file class action lawsuits against the websites for the addictive nature and the harm that was created. And as part of that, it tries to force the companies to set up an auditing program of any feature or part of their service that might possibly have addictive qualities and to try to stop those before they put those into effect. So that's kind of the simplest summary of the bill.
Yeah, a really good summary of it. I read through it this morning and looked at the different changes that took place and sort of what was defined. One of the things that I note right off the bat from what you were just discussing, what you were just talking about, is that the scope seems awfully broad. Am I understanding that correctly? Like, what is it? It almost feels like in the text they get very sort of hinty at what they're trying to focus on instead of actually just saying it outright. And so I'm curious, with the broadness of this, what does it mean for, as they see it, as they seem to see it, a social media company to employ addictive tactics? Are we talking about a little animation that comes up when you get a like? Or what is the actual addictive nature of social media as far as these lawmakers seem to see it?
It seems incredibly broad, and it really does seem, with this bill, really open to interpretation. The language is written in a very broad way, and it's one of these things that it really kind of leaves it up to the courts, you mm-hmm. know, because it allows people to file all of these suits. You know, almost anyone can file a lawsuit or make it a class action lawsuit over these features and claim that there was some sort of addictive nature to something that the platforms did. So I think, you know, my major concern with the bill is how it just becomes open season for lawsuits on all sorts of websites.
Yeah, so let's get into that. I'm curious to hear, well, I read your opinion on the piece, but I would love if you shared that kind of with our listeners, because you go into detail, you have some great passages in here from another piece, and I'm curious kind of when you heard about this going through, I believe TechDirt wrote about it, or when you heard about this kind of making its way through the system, you'd heard, you wrote about it, but mm-hmm. now that it has passed in one of the legislative bodies, you've got more thoughts. And so kind of your take on this bill, particularly with the quote unquote, save the children nature of things.
Right. And so, you know, there are lots of bills, you know, both at the federal congressional level and in a bunch of state legislatures that are very focused on this idea that, you know, children are at risk. And it's a sort of a very easy political move to do. Save the children, protect the children, think of the children, you know. And the fact is that, you know, childhood is not perfect for everyone. And certainly people go through periods of times where they're depressed or they encounter challenges or in the process of trying to figure out who they are, especially as teenagers, high school age students, you know, they go through phases. And some of those phases, you know, may be dangerous and may certainly be risky. But this bill effectively allows parents to blame and sue social media for each of those things. And I find that to be really risky. You know, certainly nobody wants their kids to be depressed, or nobody wants their kids to have eating disorders or to go through other, areas where they may consider self-harm. You know, those are obviously very scary and problematic issues, and they're issues that society should be working on dealing with. But I don't think blaming Facebook for that is a realistic answer or one that will actually help.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talk about in the piece, of course, you just mentioned it there, is sort of a pivot of that responsibility from the part of the parents to the part of social media. So a scenario, I have a child under 18 and they are on social media and they get to a place where they are using social media regularly to the extent that it affects their schoolwork. It starts to affect mm-hmm. their relationships with other people. They say that they would like to focus less on social media, but feel like they can't. And maybe we even go as far as going and seeing a neurologist or a neuropsychologist who does an EEG and can see that there's heightened activity in the pleasure centers of the brain when they use the social media, Twitter, or well, I guess mm-hmm. a child would not be using Twitter, but Instagram. It's only for us old people who use Twitter. Anyway, so that seems to show this social media addiction that some psychologists and sociologists have talked about. Now I can go to, in this case, Instagram, or go to the courts and say, my child is addicted to social media. They're not going to pass high school and have to, you know, go to summer school. And now you owe me, I can't even remember, what was it,
$25,000.
Yeah, $25,000 for this issue. Where is the sort of larger concern that we see from the Cal Matters article that you quoted from Adam Seif, who talked about kind of the concerns about free speech in regard to this situation?
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of concerns, and I do think that the bill raises some constitutional issues, specifically around the First Amendment and free speech, because it's effectively, you know, trying to regulate forms of speech on the internet, and therefore there are some real concerns, and I think Adam lays them out, and he's a constitutional lawyer and a law professor, so he understands a lot of the issues. But it's all of these bills, it's a tricky situation when you're looking to regulate the internet, and again, there are all of these bills in all sorts of state houses and in Washington D.C. Where there's this fine line between regulating conduct and regulating speech. And I think a lot of these bills and the effort to sort of appeal to a kind of popular audience and to say, we're saving the children, ignores that line and definitely gets at regulating speech and limiting speech rather than specifically trying to regulate conduct. And that's tricky when you're dealing with a platform, the internet as a whole, that is mostly made up of speech, right? Mm-hmm. There are some conduct elements to it, but it is majority is speech. And so you have to be really, really careful and really, really thoughtful how you would approach any kind of regulatory, intervention here. And I think this bill ignores that entirely and just goes down this path that is clearly regulating speech. And I think that if this bill actually does pass and becomes law, then it will be challenged and it will almost certainly be thrown out on First Amendment grounds.
Now, one of the things in this piece that I think is, or not in this piece, but rather in the bill, it says content means anything communicated by means of an internet service, publicly or privately, including written material or messages, oral communications, et cetera. They talk about sort of what is not considered applicable here. And they do have a lot in there, including social media platform. Here it is. Social media platform does not include any of the following: an email service, an SMS and MMS service, a service offering one-to-one communication orally, a business that is an internal resource or tool, even as far as going into posting comments or reviews related to content produced and published by the provider. And I think they even go as far as to say the content that is posted to these different platforms from different users is not included in that. It is just the sort of right. Social media platforms. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think that that's where people kind of can get hung up, because it does sound like they're trying to separate the two. But right. I think the bigger concern here is precedence, right?
Yeah. And so that's exactly what that section is trying to do. It is looking to they know that this bill is going to get challenged. And when they go to court, they want to point to that section and say, see, look, we're not regulating anyone's speech. We're only trying to regulate the conduct. The issue is that, so the way that California would argue this is that they will say that, it's the features of the service. So things like likes and notifications and whatnot that are the addictive quality. And it's not the content that is bringing people back. I think that's a really difficult argument to make. Mm-hmm. The reason that people are using Instagram and TikTok and whatever else is not the the likes and the notifications. It's the content that they're receiving. Mm-hmm. You know, this bill tries to effectively ignore that and insist that that is not the case. And I think that's a really difficult argument to make. And I think that the courts will have a difficult time believing that the state is just narrowly regulating that type of activity rather than, you know, attaching it to the underlying content.
Yeah. And in the Cal Matters article, he even makes the argument that algorithms could very well fall within First Amendment rights because those algorithms are created by human beings that are setting certain editorial rules for those. So fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that issue is kind of complicated, and it's one that I think is important to think through. This idea that, like, recommendation algorithm, is that protected speech? And there's a really strong argument that it is, because a recommendation is an opinion. You know, it is suggesting what you should be reading, and that is a form of expression. And therefore, there's a very strong argument, and there are a number of different precedents that suggest that recommendation algorithms are protected speech, and any attempt to regulate them would run afoul of the First Amendment.
My last question for you, should this bill make it through the Senate and get signed by the governor of California, what are your sort of crystal ball predictions of how social media companies will respond to this? Are they going to wait for the Supreme Court to shoot it down? Are they going to immediately ban all people under the age of 18 or claim to be under the age of 18? How do you think this plays out if it is going to pass?
I mean, it's a big question. I mean, you know, there's a number of different paths that they could take, you know, based on how they've responded to different, but in some ways related bills in Florida and Texas. I think what they will do is sue, and mm-hmm. and they will sue to invalidate the law and say that the law violates the First Amendment, and also is preempted by Section 230. And there's a few other, you know, legal paths that they can take. I'm sure they will discuss the idea of, like, you know, banning people under the age of 18. I think that's kind of the nuclear option. I don't think that they would do that immediately, but I have no direct insight into what any of the platforms would necessarily do. But the most likely thing is they would go to court, try and stop the law, and then, you know, have that process play out, which may take a few years before it's determined. And ultimately, I think pretty clearly the courts, unless something major changes, the courts would find this bill unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike Masnick, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us here on Tech News Weekly. Of course, folks can head over to techdirt.com to check out your work. Is there anywhere else they should go and watch out for those algorithms that are addicting them?
I do rattle on Twitter quite often. So Twitter at M Masnick. It is if you want to see the pre-processed thoughts before I write stuff out more carefully on TechDirt.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, is DuckDuckGo as privacy focused as we want to believe? We will hear about that shortly. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Melissa. You know Melissa. Poor data quality can cost organizations an average of $15 million each year. The longer poor quality data stays in your system, the more losses you could accumulate. To ensure your business is successful, your customer information needs to be accurate. Melissa is a leading provider of global data quality and address management solutions. There's another side to accurate data: customer service. If you address someone with the wrong name or verify the wrong address when dealing with an already frustrated customer, things can get awkward real quick. You need Melissa's identity solutions. Melissa's real-time identity verification service includes identity, ID, and document verification, age authentication, and global watchlist screening to establish the identity of a consumer or satisfy AML KYC compliance. You can easily tailor the service to your specific sign-up process and risk management requirements to ensure fast onboarding or e-commerce checkout while protecting your organization against fraud. With Melissa, you'll reduce risk, ensure compliance, and keep customers happy. That means you're protecting your data from decay with 2.1 billion clean, validated records and complete customer records that add missing names, addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses. You can verify addresses, emails, phone numbers, and names in real time with Melissa. Their global address verification service verifies addresses for 240-plus countries and territories at the point of entry. Duplicate information hurts your bottom line. Melissa's data matching will help eliminate clutter and duplicates, increasing the accuracy of the database, reducing postage and mailing costs. And Melissa has batch address cleansing. It has identity verification, geocoding enrichments, email verification, also a lookups app on both iOS and Google Play to search addresses, names, and more at your fingertips. Flexible deployment options as well to suit any preference, business size, or budget, with flexible on-prem web service, secure FTP processing, and software as a service delivery options. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox when 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. Thank you, Melissa, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Jason?
All right. DuckDuckGo, as you mentioned, carved out a place for itself in this like sea of search engines, specifically around privacy, right? It's the browser. Well, they have a browser, but the search engine itself has been an option for people who are hyper-focused on keeping their searches private and secure. This is really DuckDuckGo's total identity. Bleeping Computer reported this week that it's perhaps, at least its browser product, might not be as tracker-free as some might believe. And we're going to dive right into that. Joining us to talk about this is my good friend and a familiar face to all twits, Tom Merritt. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Hey, thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
Awesome to have you here, man. It's always great to see you on the other side of the glass. So let's talk a little bit about DuckDuckGo. You wrote about it, so we're going to dive right in. Before we kind of get to Microsoft's involvement and why people are, you know, kind of up in arms about this, talk a little bit about their mission, DuckDuckGo's mission. I know, you know, there are times where DuckDuckGo is the right solution for me. I'm sure everybody, you know, can find reasons to go to DuckDuckGo. They want that secure search engine experience. How have they done in recent years in cultivating that kind of identity around their search engine and competing to others, behemoths like Google?
Yeah, their marketing is very focused around privacy. Even very recently, they've been calling out Google for tracking and pointing out that the DuckDuckGo search engine is anonymous. They're very transparent about how the search engine works in recording your IP address, but not building profiles. It does sell ads, which is kind of how it got in the trouble that we're going to talk about in a minute. But the ads are contextual. They are not built around a profile. So they are not trying to say, well, we think this person likes this kind of stuff. They're saying, well, this person is searching for cats on the moon, so let's, you know, try to sell them pet products or something like that. We're very familiar with DuckDuckGo's privacy protection on the search engine. As you mentioned, they also have a browser that they have been trying to promote as an alternative to other privacy-protecting browsers like Brave. And the DuckDuckGo privacy brand from search was supposed to be applied to this browser, which it mostly is.
Mostly. They should put that on the, if they sold it in stores, they'd put it on the box.
I don't know if they're going to use that as a poll quote or anything.
It's mostly secure, mostly private. All right. So we get the news now that there's this like Microsoft, I don't know if it's a partnership or whatever it is behind the scenes. There's some sort of deal that DuckDuckGo has with Microsoft that brings them into the mix. Explain how that works from what we understand, from what we know. And like you said, this is, I think there's probably been some confusion in how this has been reported around the browser product versus the search product. This is specific to the browser, I believe. What is Microsoft's involvement there?
No, exactly. And as you mentioned, a security researcher named Zach Edwards discovered that the browser, which says it's not allowing tracking, was allowing a particular type of tracking for Microsoft, on non-Microsoft sites. If it was on Microsoft, it wouldn't be a problem. That's first-party tracking. Mm-hmm. And even Brave doesn't, by default, block first-party tracking. So that wouldn't have been a problem. But it was allowing third-party Microsoft tracking, and a very specific kind. The kind of tracking it was allowing was a script that DuckDuckGo's browser was blocking from loading from Facebook, from Google, but not from Microsoft. It was still blocking setting third-party cookies. It was still blocking fingerprinting. So DuckDuckGo's defense is to say, like, we are still protecting your privacy more than most browsers, more than Chrome, more than Safari, et cetera. But it hadn't been transparent that this particular tracking script, which could send some telemetry back to Microsoft, was allowed to load. Gabriel Weinberg posted on Twitter that this was because of the deal DuckDuckGo has with Microsoft for search syndication. The search results on the DuckDuckGo search engine come from Microsoft, in part. And the advertising is also sold through a search syndication with Microsoft. As part of that deal, apparently, they had a provision that prevented DuckDuckGo from blocking the tracking on the browser. And Weinberg also said that there was a provision of confidentiality, which had prevented them from telling anyone about it. My guess is that when that deal was signed for search, DuckDuckGo didn't contemplate making a browser at any point. And so lawyers being lawyers, you know, they try to push to get as much as possible, push DuckDuckGo into allowing that, with DuckDuckGo thinking, well, that doesn't impact search. And now it does. Gabriel Weinberg has said, we're trying to get Microsoft to change that provision so that we can also block that particular kind of tracking on the browser as well. But we'll see if they can get that done.
I guess where my mind is heading with this is, you know, the question of, okay, so DuckDuckGo is a, you know, as we've said, privacy focused product. People use that product because they believe they're getting the most privacy protection, let's say, whether they are or not. That's, you know, that's what is out there to believe. Why the exception here with Microsoft? I mean, specifically, like, what I want to know is, yeah, if there are other deals kind of like this, and Microsoft's just the one that's been discovered. But
sure,
I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a matter of trust, right?
Yeah,
I get where DuckDuckGo came from, which is, we made a deal before we made a browser, and it made us do this thing, make this exception, and we couldn't tell anybody about it because of the deal. But that is a legitimate question. What other deals do you have? The thing is, the security researcher that found this, Zach Edwards, found that Facebook was being blocked. Google was being blocked. So there's no obvious exceptions other than Microsoft. My guess is there probably aren't any other exceptions outside of Microsoft. There might be some other Microsoft stuff happening that hasn't been discovered, but it's not obvious stuff like cookies or fingerprinting or anything like that. That all checks out. So this is more a matter of perception than actual damage. In the end, DuckDuckGo's browser does a better job than almost every browser out there, except for maybe Brave and a few others, at protecting your privacy. And it had this one little exception, which it's now doing the right thing and saying, okay, now that it's out there and the confidentiality agreement, has been maybe not breached, but you know, has been bypassed by public conversation, we can say we're trying to get Microsoft to change this. I think DuckDuckGo has done everything right since it became public, and probably was stuck in a corner because of a legal agreement that, in hindsight, it shouldn't have agreed to, but maybe they just didn't realize what they were agreeing to at the time would prevent them from making a browser, because they had no plans to making a browser. If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, especially when you're getting into business in the search engine market, right? Like, what a business to, like, try and break into. For DuckDuckGo, I've always kind of appreciated how well they've done, considering the behemoths that they're always up against. And, you know, so they were able to, I believe, successfully carve out kind of a corner of that search engine market, and capitalize also on this, like, rising awareness in the public sphere around privacy and protection. So I give them a lot of credit for pulling off what they have at a time where it really seemed like, hey, why would you even come out with a search engine engine. There are no search engines that can compete anymore. So at least there's that. There is a lot of value to disclosure. And I think at the end of the day, this is a ripe example of that, right? Like, if, do you think the situation would have been different if when DuckDuckGo released this browser, it had it as an asterisk on the App Store or the Play Store, and it said, you know, it made some sort of disclosure about this Microsoft thing, we'd probably be in a different place right now, I would imagine.
Absolutely. The right thing for them to do would be to have disclosed this. It sounds like, and this is a little mushy, Weinberg is implying that the confidentiality agreement prevented them from doing that. But there's also App Store rules that require that sort of disclosure. And they say they're working on changing their App Store descriptions to address that. I think they could have done possibly a little better, either by pushing back on Microsoft to say, hey, we're launching this browser and this is a problem. It's possible that they just didn't think anyone would find out until they got it switched. And then they thought, well, if we get it switched, then no one needs to know. And because we're protecting privacy more than most browsers anyway, we don't feel bad about it. That would be the only hint of hubris I could detect there. But otherwise, I mean, I don't know that if I'm DuckDuckGo, I wouldn't have agreed to that same amount of terms to get the advertising deal done, because without the advertising deal, you don't have a business plan for a search engine, because so far nobody's been able to make a subscription-based search engine work. You can see email, you see somebody like Proton doing subscription-based and not taking ads and doing better and better all the time. But people just aren't willing to pay for search engines yet. So you had to compromise somewhere. And that, I think that's the little space in the armor that let this through.
Yeah, indeed. I totally agree with you. At this point in the game though, are you concerned at all? Are you a fan of DuckDuckGo? Do you use it? And would this impact your desire to use it in the future?
Sure. Yeah, I use DuckDuckGo as my default on mobile, for sure. And I think they're very good. There are times when I still have to turn to Google for particular things, but for, you know, run-of-the-mill everyday searches, they're great. This is not going to change my using them for that, because this is about the browser. I wasn't using the browser. And even my friend Scott Johnson, who uses the browser, is not going to turn away from them because of this, because again, he's like, well, I would have preferred knowing about this, but it's still protecting my privacy more than others. And I'm not that concerned about it, but I think it is going to be felt by DuckDuckGo, because lots of other people are not going to take this well, and people have knee-jerk reactions and are going to apply it to the search engine as well as the browser, because what you said earlier about trust, they're going to say, well, I don't know what else you're not disclosing, so I'm not going to trust you anymore.
Yeah, some people are very, very unforgiving. And when it comes to privacy, I mean, understandably so, right?
People are especially sensitive about privacy. So, and there's also that internet sense of you said one thing and you did another, right? The hypocrisy of it is going to drive people crazy, where they're like, you've been saying you're the most private and then you did this and now we will never forgive you.
Yeah. What keeps popping up in my mind is the comment you meant, mind you, you were speculating around this, but was the comment of like, I just didn't think I would get caught. And that right there always stings, you know, as like, as a reason or a rationale for something that never really works very well. Never makes people happy, let's just say. Finally, take a couple of minutes. Tell us about your new newsletter. You just launched this recently. That's why we have you on in the first place, because I read your newsletter. And I was like, dang, I got to get Tom on. So tell us about it.
Hey, thanks, man. Yeah, Tech Tom, like Tech Time, but with Tom. TechTom.substack.com. It's a lot of the writing I do for the Daily Tech News Show adapted for reading. So when there's a big story like the DuckDuckGo story, I'll put that out for everybody to read for free. And there's some special, more in-depth things, like a weekly roundup that I just put out for paid subscribers. But it's sort of as the news comes in, it gets published. TechTom.substack.com.
Right on. Everybody should go and check that out. Yet another vector for Tom Merritt awesomeness. Tom, you are so great. Thank you so much for hopping on today. It's always great to get to talk to you.
Hey, thanks, man. It's good to talk to you.
We'll see you soon. And best of luck with the Substack. Appreciate it. All right. Up next, you're going to dive into a little bit around the Apple self-repair service.
Yeah.
Of which I saw a couple of really large crates in our office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait to hear you talk about that. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is Checkout.com. We talk about innovation, groundbreaking innovation on this show and on this network all the time. That's because tech should be groundbreaking. It should be innovating all the time. Traditional payment systems, they're heavily layered, they're disconnected, they're perceived as a cost center to the business. So modern businesses actually need flexible payment systems that can help them adapt to change, to grow, to scale fast, all the things you want when you're growing your business. We recently came across a company with technology that approaches payments through a radical new lens, Checkout.com. Checkout.com is a leading digital global payment solution provider. Brands like Grab, Sony Electronics, Wise, Henkel, just to name a few, they're everywhere. Checkout's flexible payments platform is purpose-built. It has performance, scalability, and speed in mind. It's ideal for businesses looking to seamlessly integrate better payment solutions globally. Maybe yours is. With a dedicated team of local experts spanning 19 offices in 5 continents, Checkout.com offers a strategic partnership to help businesses improve their acceptance rates, to optimize their payments performance, to grow their business globally. Checkout.com exists to enable businesses and their communities to thrive in this digital economy. It's kind of necessary at this point. They deliver innovative payment solutions that flex to your needs, provide valuable insights that can help you get smart about your payments performance, and expertise that you can count on as you navigate the complexities of an ever-shifting digital world. And you get so much with Checkout.com right out of the gate. You get global optimization. They actually provide local acquiring in multiple geographies. That improves your authorization rates and lowers your costs, thankfully. Transparency, they have a very transparent fee structure. It's clear, it's straightforward. They have in-depth reporting that gives you visibility no matter where you happen to operate. Also, local expertise, dedicated local teams that actually bring regional, international, and regulatory expertise. That allows you to navigate market complexities with confidence. It's like you have the team on your side. And then finally, strategic partnership. They actually take a collaborative, personalized approach to solving complex problems for their merchants and their ecosystem partners. And personally, I actually also really appreciate they have a super simple API that developers, if you're a developer and you want to integrate this, help integrate this into your business, they just make it really easy. It's just a short blip of code and you get all of the benefits of Checkout.com. Discover how Checkout.com can help your business thrive. All you got to remember is checkout.com/TNW. That should be easy to remember. Checkout.com/TNW. Make sure and use that URL. That way they know that you heard about it through Tech News Weekly. And we thank Checkout.com for their support of this show. All right, Micah, tell us all about it.
Breathe in.
Oh, was that good of an experience?
Breathe out. Yeah. So here's the deal. A while back, I believe it was actually last year, and may have been last year, Apple announced that it was going to be introducing what it called the self-service repair program. At the time, there weren't many details. The company said, hey, we're going to be doing this thing that allows people to get the parts and the tools that they need to be able to fix their own devices. We'll launch with a limited number of parts and tools for those parts, and it's going to be handled by a third party. So we waited and waited, and then some articles went out on some different publications that were saying, remember how Apple said they were going to do this thing? They have yet to do this thing. And then not too long after that, Apple put out a new announcement saying, hey, we've got it all in place. We're ready to do this. They launched with a company called Spot, S-P-O-T. And it's you can go to selfservicerepair.com, which is Apple's self-service repair store for Apple products. And this is where you get the genuine Apple parts and the genuine Apple tools to do the process. So I wanted to see what it was like to do a self-service repair using Apple's now official process. Of note,
I have fixed, I've replaced batteries in MacBook Pros. I've fixed iPhone screens. I've replaced batteries in iPhones. I've done a lot of those different repairs. I've always used iFixit, iFixit.com. You go there, you type in the name of your device. I've fixed Kindles that way. I have a really old Kindle that I love. It's the Kindle keyboard. And it was a, I think it was a Christmas present or a graduation gift, one of the two. And like to this day, it means a lot to me, but also it works great. And the problem was that the battery kept dying. So twice now I've replaced the battery and then it's like new again.
And when you did that, how easy was that process?
I went to iFixit. I looked up my Kindle. I ordered the piece and it came in the mail, you know, maybe within the week. It was a little low on instructions, but that was, again, at the time. So I had to take, you know, pry it open, get it plopped in, and then it was fine. It was not that hard. What was more difficult, the most difficult repair I've ever done was fixing a friend's MacBook Pro battery. I essentially had to completely take apart the whole machine on the inside.
Oh my God, that sounds so stressful to me.
I flipped it over and I had all my stuff laid out. I had my screwdrivers going. Everything had to come out of the device, and at the end,
and you had to put it in order,
exactly.
And in
its own little place,
so you
the screws
you reverse
need to go.
It. Oh gosh,
everything,
yeah,
and then you also had to use iFixit had this adhesive removal kit that had like acetone or some similar substance to remove the glue and be able to pull it all apart.
Yeah.
In any case, the instructions were there. I had all the pieces I needed. It was great. It worked fine. So. Fast forward to wanting to do this self-service repair. I've got an iPhone 12 that I use as a camera. And my main iPhone is an iPhone 13. So I had this extra iPhone 12 that I use as a camera, and we wanted to fix originally we were going to fix the display in it, but that is actually a really expensive process. So it didn't have a broken screen. It was fine. Mm-hmm. We would have been breaking it to do the repair. And that's a lot. If it was an iPhone SE, we could have done that. But with an iPhone 12, that screen is very expensive. So we decided, let's just replace the battery in it. That's not a very hard repair. And it'll also give us a chance to check everything out. So hopped onto the self-service repair store for Apple products, started my order, went through the process that I've got an iPhone 12 Pro Max that I need to replace the battery in, ordered the parts. And part of the process that's involved is you can order the parts, but you can also order Apple's official tools that help you take apart the device, okay? So they give you access to the repair manual, the official Apple repair manual, and you actually have to go through it and find there's a special code in it that you then have to type in to show that you read it, basically. So they just want to make sure before they let you do this that you actually did do your
I can respect
that's
that.
Fair. You need to do your homework before you can do this repair, especially if you want to like maintain a warranty or something like that. Right. So it costs $49 to rent the tools from Apple, and you get them for 7 days. Okay. So I went through, placed the order, did all of that stuff. They do put a temporary hold on your card for the cost of the tools that you get. So you might be thinking you're going in for maybe $150. There will be, until you return the tools, an $1,100 charge on your card. For some people with credit cards where there's a lot of room, that's not a big deal, but I think about where I'm from, where a lot of the people that I know don't have credit cards with a whole lot of room on them, and in some cases have to use debit cards. And so they, you know, having $1,100 hold on the card actually is not a great thing. So anyway, do have a problem with that personally, but did that. And I got the notification. I was so excited. Ooh, the packages are coming in the mail. I've actually got them here. They ship these gigantic boxes. These are Pelican cases. They ship in these two gigantor Pelican cases. There's foam inside that's shaped for the different tools that are in there. And I got a UPS tracking number, right? And it was a three-part shipment. There were two shipping numbers for both of those cases and one shipping number for the actual part that I need to do the repair. So last Thursday, I got a notification that two things were delivered. And the night before, I got a notification saying we were delayed in getting the shipment onto the, you know, truck or whatever. I can't remember exactly what words they used. So a new shipping, a new delivery time will come later. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I come into the studio and I figured that I didn't know at the time that it was multiple shipping numbers. So when I saw that it was delivered, I thought that meant everything. Mm-hmm. So I came in and there's my Twitter where I was like, talk about extra. These boxes are huge, but stay tuned because we're going to be doing a video. Lo and behold, I open those up. There's no battery inside for me to actually do the replacement. There's no replacement adhesive for me to do the replacement. There's no screws that I'm supposed to be using to do the replacement. What the heck is going on? I check the tracking number. That's when I find out there are three parts. And the part that hasn't arrived yet is the part that I actually need to do the repair. So remember, I've got 7 days to return this or else they're going to keep that $1,100 charge on my card, right? So I reach out to the self-service repair store and say, hey, just need to get a clarification here. I haven't gotten the repair part yet. I've got 7 days to make the return. That's once everything has arrived, right? No. What? No. As soon as you get the tools, that's when the countdown starts. I said, excuse me, I can't do the repair.
That is so bizarre.
I cannot do the repair until I get the piece. And they said on the phone, and I am, paraphrasing a little bit, but these words were used. This is an ongoing problem with our policy. So change it. I said, all right, if I don't get the part in time, then I'm going to have to return the tools so I don't get charged for them, and then I can't do the replacement of the battery. Yeah. Okay. Can I talk to someone who might be able to talk to me about an extension on that rental?
Yeah.
Yes, we'll have to have a manager call you back. I gave them two phone numbers. If you don't reach me at the first one, call me on the second one. I haven't heard anything from them.
Are you serious? So when are these due to go back?
These have to go back tomorrow. So I have to get them to UPS tomorrow morning at the latest. UPS said,
what a waste of time,
a waste money? Of time, a waste of money, a whole hunkin' box of anxiety. And like, the package is supposed to arrive today. However, and this is where UPS is at issue, it was in California on Monday. They sent it, it came from, from wherever to Illinois. From Illinois to California. They sent it back to Illinois.
Oh, are you kidding me?
On Tuesday, and then sent it back to us from there. So yesterday, I got a notification that, hey, actually, your package is going to arrive today, Wednesday, yesterday. At that point, I'm looking at it going, yeah, right. And I was right. At like 11 p.m., it said, your package is set to arrive today still. No, it's not. You're closed. So supposed to come today. If it does not come today, then I literally will not be able to use all of these tools to do the repair. I don't wish this on my worst enemy to have to deal with all of this.
Yeah.
When I could go, and let's just go right now, ifixit.com. I will type in at the top in the search bar, iPhone 12 Pro Max. I find the iPhone 12 Pro Max. I want to replace the battery for the iPhone 12 Pro Max. And so I will scroll and find the battery. Where is that? There's the featured guide for replacing the battery, but I don't think it has the link in it. There we go. iPhone 12 Pro Max battery replacement. With the tools included, the fix kit that has an eye opener, it has the necessary screwdrivers or drivers, it has the suction cups that you need, and the battery, and adhesive, $45 for the whole thing.
And you get it within a few days.
And you get it within a few days. And if I wanted to just get the battery, because I've got all the iFixit tools myself, as I do, only $40. And none of this stress and overhead and nonsense that's involved in these Pelican cases. So I, to say the least, I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah, disappointment, right?
I'm very disappointed.
I'd be disappointed
with,
too.
This is the thing that annoys me the most is that Apple is going to get to say, we hired a third party to do this. This is on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's, I'm sure, why they did it. Because it's that company's responsibility to figure out the logistics. It's that company's responsibility to get the pieces to where they need to go.
I mean, I feel like I heard this already on the network, and it could have been you, it could have been someone else. I can't remember who said it, but it, because we talked about this. Did we talk about this with Dan Morin a few weeks ago?
We may have, yeah.
And so maybe it was Dan.
It was when they actually finally launched it.
Right, when they finally launched it. That's right. So it's probably from that conversation where someone said, either you or Dan said, like, this was the minimum amount that Apple actually had to do to be able to say, we support self-repair. See?
Yes.
We're doing the right thing. Meanwhile, it's like, honestly, it feels very passive-aggressive.
Yeah, so this is, Wade didn't coin the term, but he called out the term perfectly this past Saturday. It's called malicious compliance.
Malicious compliance.
And it is that thing where when you tell your brother who's annoying you, when you say, stop poking me. And so instead of poking you, they start slapping you.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not poking you.
Right.
You said I can't poke you.
Right.
Malicious compliance. And not to mention, this cannot be environmentally friendly to send these Pelican cases out all the time to these different places for people who are wanting to do the self-service repair.
No, absolutely. It feels very irresponsible.
And they ship the package back to Illinois and back out to California, so that's even more carbon waste.
I mean, I can already hear Apple saying, no, but this is necessary if you want to do it right. Like,
yeah, of course.
We could ship out, you know, a little kit that iFixit does, but you're probably going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
This, you know, if we're going to, is there any sort of like, they don't certify it after you fix it, like
you do
this,
have
right?
to you have to contact the self-service repair program, and they download this special thing to your phone that you then it does a thing to make
Scanned.
Sure that everything is where it's supposed to be and how it's supposed to be. So there is a little bit more of a process involved, but I've also heard, because there have been a few other people who have done this who didn't have the UPS issue, who actually did get all the pieces and parts in time, who said that it was so much harder to do it this way than it was to do it like an iFixit route, because, well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. I don't want to get too much into it because, fingers crossed, I'm still getting the tools today or the part today so that we can actually do this video that I really want to do.
I hope so.
Because otherwise, like I said, it just has to go back. And that would be ridiculous.
Wow.
So.
And I'm also curious to know if they know that it's an issue, that the kit is arriving before the part, how are they shipping how is the part being shipped?
Yeah,
is it an overnight thing?
Right. It has to be shipped separately if there's an issue. Because, like I said, it was one tracking number that had three tracking numbers kind of built into it. Which I had remembered UPS doing that in the past, but I always got them all at the same time. So the fact that they didn't... that they didn't come in at all, that the third package didn't come in. My suggestion, Tim, good morning, Tim Apple. My suggestion for you is to call your friends at Spot and tell them, hey, send out the part first. And then once it's delivered, send out the tools.
Hey, that's not a bad idea.
Because they're going to keep the part. Like, the part is a thing that they will keep no matter what.
Yeah.
The tools are the things that have to go back. So
how fast did you get the tools?
The tools were within a week.
Oh, so it was still a good
Yeah, it wasn't an overnight or anything like that. Or at least from my end, it wasn't an overnight.
Right.
Who knows how long it took them to get it together and then send them out.
And I suppose that's kind of part of the issue here, too, is that, you know, like, you review phones. You've probably got a couple of phones, you know, in your possession. If you need to be out a phone, you're okay.
Exactly that.
Somebody else.
Somebody who's actually, and this is what I'm saying. When I lived in Missouri, it was a 3-hour drive to the nearest Apple store. That's why I went to iFixit and fixed things when they were broken, because I'm not going to drive 3 hours. The gas that costs, the payment that you have to pay at the time for the repair.
Drop it off. Come back later.
Some people don't have multiple phones. They have their one phone, and that's why they're doing this, because they think, oh, I can do it in one day. I can get my phone fixed. Now they're just stuck. And then on top
nightmare.
Of that, like, there's so much about this that's just ridiculous. So
I hope you get the part. I would love to see the final product.
As Anthony pointed out, even if I don't get the part, we'll at least do a tour of the tools so you can see what I would have been using to do the repair.
I mean, that's really, honestly, that's part of the that's a big part of the story, right?
Yeah, it is kind of about the tools. There are some really cool things. I've already looked in those boxes. Oh, that's the other, they come with these red zip tag things on them. And so you have to cut them so people, you would know if someone else had opened them. And then they ship in the box new ones to put on before you send it back. It's all very, you know, kind of official or whatever. But yeah, inside of that, those two boxes, there's some pretty neat tools that need to go back. So, yeah.
Well, I hope it all works out.
That's me too. Me too. All right. Let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our pals at ZipRecruiter before we hear about how to protect yourself from social media dissociation. ZipRecruiter is the sponsor this week. Certain people just make life so much easier. You've got those people that do that. You don't know what you'd do without them. Maybe it's your partner, your friend, or your personal assistant. It's like if you need to grow your business, ZipRecruiter makes hiring so much easier because they do the work for you. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. ZipRecruiter's technology finds the right candidates for your job, and you can invite your top choices to apply. So they go, oh, nice, I got an invite. This is great. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the #1 rated hiring site based on G2 ratings as of January 1st, 2022. The hardest thing you have to do is to remember our special URL. We keep it simple. To try ZipRecruiter for free, just remember this URL. It's ziprecruiter.com/TNW. Again, that's ziprecruiter.com/TNW. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Jason Howell, take it away.
So I realized as you were talking with Mike Masnick that there's definitely some crossover between that story and the one that the research that I ran across. So social media, obviously, a huge part of everyone's lives. It's a huge part of the technology landscape right now. You love it or hate it, you're probably on social media at this point in one way or another. Well, researchers at the University of Washington did a study to analyze the ways that we actually use social media. And I'm sure there are a lot of studies that do this. This one was a little unique. It focused actually on kind of the dissociative qualities of social media when we use it.
Sorry, could you repeat that? I was zoned out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Come back to
okay,
me.
Okay, here we
dissociative
go.
Dissociative qualities of social media.
Got it.
Sorry, I have to remind you every 10 minutes right. to come back.
I got to sue somebody for social media addiction. Too.
Right. And specifically how social media impacts our lives as we're using it, how it shapes how we feel about ourselves, all of these things. And what is this? And this is what really kind of resonates between the Masnick article and what we're talking about here. What is this addictive, and I'll put that in air quotes, addictive quality that we feel that users talk about when they talk about their social media use? I know I've felt that at times, like, oh, so addicted to Twitter. I need to like take a break. I need to take a step back because every little moment is me staring at the feed and scrolling.
Doom scrolling, as they say.
It feels like an addiction, right? Because it's this habit that we're so used to doing. Well, the group presented its findings. It was a paper titled, I don't even remember what I read, how design influences dissociation on social media. This was presented earlier this month at the 2022 conference on human factors in computing.
Ooh, and I can't wait to read this thing now. That sounds like a really good piece.
They had participants using Twitter via a specific app called Chirp. And the reason that they were using a specific app is because they could build certain things into the app experience to facilitate for the study. And they could watch people's behavior while using it. Now, granted, the people weren't like in a room. They weren't being analyzed while they were using it. It was more during the course of an entire month. Mm-hmm. Those people would use Twitter via Chirp for all their Twitter interactions, their browsing, that sort of stuff. When they're using the app after 3 minutes of interacting with it, they would be asked on a scale of 1 to 5 how much they agreed with this statement. I am currently using Chirp without really paying attention to what I'm doing. And then afterwards, that would pop up every 15 minutes. So depending on your usage, you'd get this prompt every once in a while. And it served as kind of like an interruption, right? Because so often we pull out our phones, we scroll. Next thing we know, it's an hour later. and you've fallen down that rabbit hole and you're like, what just happened to the past hour?
What?
I don't even know what I read. Like, I couldn't even tell you, like, recite to you what I read, but I read something for the past hour and people were outraged, or whatever the case may be.
Fugue state.
Yes. This acted as a way to kind of interrupt that mesmerizing kind of hypnosis of sorts, and ask, like, where are you right now? Are you actually engaged with what you're reading, or are you just mindlessly scrolling and kind of in a wormhole? What they found was that around half of the users strongly identified with the idea of dissociation while using Twitter. And I mean, personally, that sounds kind of low to me. I just have a hard time believing that most people at some point don't experience that kind of dissociative quality when they're using social media. It's so easy to do. The participants did say that having those ongoing interruptions actually helped bring them back from that state, kind of into a more intentional space, intentional usage space. And apparently this is the first time that the dissociative state has been documented in an academic study related to social media, which is surprising to me.
Okay, that's interesting.
Because I just feel like this is so common and so known. But the study helps to differentiate between dissociation and addiction. So the lead author, Amanda Bond, actually said, instead of I should be able to have more self-control, it's more like we all naturally dissociate in many ways throughout our day, whether it's daydreaming or scrolling through Instagram. We stop paying attention to what's happening around us. And it's very, very true. So, and then, as I said, the other part of this were the interruptions, kind of the interventions that were built into the app, those cues to kind of bring participants back. And I think ultimately, a lot of the participants recognized that as being a very powerful tool. That kind of reminded me of like TikTok, for example. If you're on TikTok for a while, you end up getting that video that's someone saying, hey, you've been using TikTok for a while.
Yeah.
Don't you think you need to take a break or whatever?
Wii used to do that. Wii, the first version of the Nintendo Wii had this, it would show kind of I don't remember it exactly, but I think birds chirped and it was showing someone going outside and it was like, hey, you should take a break. Or Netflix is very annoying. Are you still watching?
I am still watching.
Yes. Yes. Oh. So anyways, the ultimate conclusion was that lack of control is not the issue, rather platform design building in systems that ultimately prevent people from snapping into that dissociative state. So putting the onus on the platform and not the person to regulate their behavior, it sounds like.
Huh.
And I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
But,
something could come along that changes my mind, but I think I'll always be of mixed minds about that.
Yeah, because I can see the value, the benefit of a platform or an app or an OS. I mean, Android and iOS both have, kind of digital wellness features baked into it. And I think even at the time that those were rolling out, people were very like, yeah, but shouldn't you just have personal responsibility instead of the platform making these decisions for you? And like, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. We should all be personally responsible for our actions. But it's also very handy if I recognize that I have a problem with this, mm-hmm. and there's a tool that I can activate that helps to bring me back.
Yes.
Then I'm for that too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm kind of a mixed minds of it as well. But I thought it was an interesting study. Interesting because
we need to be doing these studies. No matter what it is, we need to be doing these studies. Anecdotally, I have observed in some family friends who are my sibling's age, who have heard stories and things like that. Anecdotally, I feel that there's going to be a growing issue over time with the way that the youth dopamine cycle is changed by social media, and particularly social media that involves stardom or fandom or any level of
recognition.
If you are a young person like this person that I'm thinking of, who was a video game streamer, they had gotten on the platform, they grew a base, they got pretty popular on the video game streaming, and then they had to take a step back for many different reasons, and now they're going through a period where they are having trouble feeling that reward center activated with things that are, you know, day to day, with, you know, feeling a sense of satisfaction from doing a day's work or completing certain tasks, where those would come easier to a person who didn't have that very easy, you know, people are focusing on me. I'm getting responses from people on the, I'm internet famous in you know, a limited capacity.
Those numbers. Up.
Exactly. The views, that is a huge burst of dopamine that takes place there. And I really think that we're going to be facing a certain level of reckoning. You know, there are older folks who I've heard, oh, everybody these days is depressed. Back when we were depressed, we just chewed on the gum and kept on rolling. And it's like, there are so many things that are involved with that. And I think that one of the things that's involved with that is the way that our dopamine cycles have changed. And because of that, that the effect that it has on serotonin levels and all of that, that, and also that there's more attention being paid to it, that there is more depression, you know, than we have seen in certain periods of time. So anyway, all of that, I'm glad that this research is being done, because we need to understand it so that we can prepare for it as we go forward.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. So yeah, check out the research if you're interested. This article that I found is zmescience.com. I didn't find a huge amount of source, like different publications writing about this, maybe a handful, but this was definitely the best, most informative article that had some information about the study. And then of course you can, you know, take a look at the study itself if you want to go deeper, but definitely interesting stuff. All right. We've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Thank you, as always, for watching and listening each and every week. We do this show every Thursday. So if you go to twit.tv/TNW, there you can find all the ways to subscribe. So you don't even have to think about what day it is and when it's going to come and how am I going to find it, because you just open up your podcatcher and there it is waiting for you. It's like magic.
If you are looking for a way to get a warm, bubbly feeling, we're just talking about dopamine, and knowing that you are supporting us here at Twit directly with these shows that you watch every week, well, I've got a way for you to do that. And it also gets you some great stuff, too. It's called Club Twit. You go to twit.tv/clubtwit. It'll cost you $7 a month. And for that $7, you get every single one of Twit shows ad-free. So you get all the content right there. You get access to the members only Twit Plus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, including unboxings that we, you know, don't maybe not publish to everybody, conversations with awesome folks both here at Twit and out in the world, and even more stuff that will be soon coming to Twit Plus. It's always growing and it's really exciting. And you get access to the Twit Discord server. That is a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. So if you've always wanted to reach out and haven't been able to do that in other ways, the Discord server is just the place for that. twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month. We also heard that some folks wanted to support us in a way that didn't have all the extra bells and whistles. If you use Apple Podcasts, you can do that. You just go into Apple Podcasts, you search for Tech News Weekly, you find the audio version of the show, and tap for $2.99 a month. You subscribe, and that will get you the audio feed without any ads, the ad-free audio version of the podcast. If you would like to tweet or follow or all those things at me, I am at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Check me out on Saturday with Leo Laporte for the Tech Guy radio show, the radio show heard around the world, where folks call in with their tech news or their tech requests and questions. And we try to answer those. And on Tuesdays for iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard, where we talk all things iOS, tvOS, HomePodOS, iPadOS. It's all the OSs
so
Apple has.
OSes.
There are too many OSs, but we try to help you make the most of those devices and those OSs. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, find me on Twitter at Jason Howell, and then doing All About Android every Tuesday at twit.tv/AAA, talking about that OS. And then big thanks to John Ashley, sitting behind the board there. Also to Burke. even more behind the scenes. He's not even in the studio right now, for helping us do this show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching and listening. We'll see y'all next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor of Ad Astra magazine, and each week I'm joined by Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief over at space.com, in our new This Week in Space podcast. Every Friday, Tarek and I take a deep dive into the stories that define the new space age. What's NASA up to? When will Americans once again set foot on the moon? And how about those samples from the Perseverance rover? When are those coming home? What the heck has Elon Musk done now? In addition to all the latest and greatest in space exploration, we'll take an occasional look at bits of spaceflight history that you probably never heard of, and all with an eye towards having a good time along the way. Check us out on your favorite podcatcher.